Chapter 38. Darkness was only a half hour away when Giordino set the helicopter down neatly within the white circle painted on the loading deck of the Alhambra. The deckhands, who simply went by the names of Jesus and Gatto, stood by to push the craft inside the cavernous auto deck and tie it down. Lauren and Gunn were standing outside the sweep of the rotor blades. When Giordino cut the ignition switch, they stepped forward. They were not alone. A man and a woman moved out of the shadow of the ferry's huge superstructure and joined them. "Any luck?" Gunn shouted above the diminishing beat of the rotors at Giordino, who was leaning out the open window of the cockpit. Giordino replied with a thumbs down. Pitt stepped from the helicopter's passenger door and knitted his thick, black eyebrows in surprise. "I didn't expect to see you two again, certainly not here." Dr. Shannon Kelsey smiled, her manner coolly dignified, while Miles Rogers pumped Pitt's hand in a genuine show of friendliness. "Hope you don't mind us popping in like this," said Rogers. "Not at all. I'm glad to see you. I assume you've all introduced yourselves to each other." "Yes, we've all become acquainted. Shannon and I certainly didn't expect to be greeted by a congresswoman and the assistant director of NUMA." "Dr. Kelsey has regaled me with her adventures in Peru," said Lauren in a voice that was low and throaty. "She's led an interesting life." Giordino exited the helicopter and stared at the newcomers with interest. "Hail, hail, the gang's all here," he said in greeting. "Is this a reunion or an old mummy hunter's convention?" "Yes, what brings you to our humble ferry in the Sea of Cortez?" asked Pitt.
"Government agents requested Miles and me to drop everything in Peru and fly here to assist your search," answered Shannon.
Pitt looked at Gunn. "Government agents?" Gunn made a know-nothing shrug and held up a piece of paper. "The facts informing us of their arrival came an hour after they showed up in a chartered boat. They insisted on waiting to reveal the purpose of their visit until you returned." "They were customs agents," Miles enlightened Pitt. "They appeared in the Pueblo de los Muertos with a high-level State Department official and played on our patriotism."
"Miles and I were asked to identify and photograph Huascar's treasure after you found it," explained Shannon. "They came to us because of my expertise in Andean culture and artifacts, Miles's reputation as a photographer, and mostly because of our recent involvement with you and NUMA."
"And you volunteered," Pitt surmised. Rogers replied, "When the customs agents informed us the gang of smugglers we met in the Andes are connected with the family of underground art dealers who are also searching for the treasure, we started packing."
"The Zolars?"
Rogers nodded.
"The possibility we might be of help in trapping Doc Miller's murderer quickly overcame any reluctance to become involved."
"Wait a minute," said Giordino. "The Zolars are involved with Amaru and the Sope Machaco?"
Rogers nodded again.
"You weren't told? No one informed you that the Sope Machaco and the Zolar family are one and the same?"
"I guess someone forgot," Giordino said caustically.
He and Pitt looked at each other as understanding dawned. Each read the other's mind, and they silently agreed not to mention their unexpected run-in with Doc Miller's impostor.
"Were you briefed on the instructions we deciphered on the Kipu?" Pitt asked Shannon, changing the subject.
Shannon nodded.
"I was given a full translation."
"By whom?"
"The courier who hand-delivered it was an FBI agent."
Pitt stared at Gunn and then Giordino with deceptive calm.
"The plot thickens.
I'm surprised Washington didn't issue press kits about the search to the news media and sell the movie rights to Hollywood."
"If word leaks out," said Giordino, "every treasure hunter between here and the polar ice caps will swarm into the Gulf like fleas after a hemophiliac St. Bernard."
Fatigue began to tighten its grip on Pitt. He was stiff and numb, and his back ached. His body demanded to lie down and rest. He had every right to be tired and discouraged.
What the hell, he thought. Why not share the despair? No good reason why he should bear the cross by himself.
I hate to say it, he said slowly, staring at Shannon, but it looks as if you and Miles made a wasted trip.
Shannon looked at him in surprise.
You haven't found the treasure site?
Did someone tell you we had?
We were led to believe you had pinned down the location, said Shannon.
Wishful thinking, said Pitt. We haven't seen a trace of a stone carving.
Are you familiar with the symbol marker described by the Khipu? Gunn asked Shannon.
Yes, she replied without hesitation, the Demonio del Muertos.
Pitt sighed. The demon of the dead. Dr. Ortiz told us. I go to the back of the class for not making the connection.
I remember, said Gunn. Dr. Ortiz was excavating a large grotesque rock sculpture with fangs and described it as a Chachapoyan god of the underworld.
Pitt repeated Dr. Ortiz's exact words. Part jaguar, part condor, part snake. He sank his fangs into whoever disturbed the dead.
The body and wings have the scales of a lizard, Shannon added to the description.
Now that you know exactly what you're looking for, Lauren said with renewed enthusiasm, the search should go easier.
So we know the ID of the beast that guards the hoard, said Giordino, bringing the conversation back to earth.
So what?
Dirk and I have examined every island that falls within the pattern, and we've come up empty. We've exhausted our search area, and what we might have missed, our competitors have likely checked off their list, too.
Al's right, Pitt admitted. We have no place left to search.
You're sure you've seen no trace of the demon? Asked Rogers.
Giordino shook his head.
Not so much as a scale or a fang.
Shannon scowled in defeat.
Then the myth is simply that. A myth.
The treasure that never was, murmured Gunn.
He collapsed dejectedly on an old wooden passenger's bench.
It's over, he said slowly.
I'll call the Admiral and tell him we're closing down the project.
Our rivals in the seaplane should be cutting bait and flying off into the sunset, too, said Giordino.
To regroup and try again, said Pitt. They're not the type to fly away from $1 billion in treasure.
Gunn looked up at him, surprised.
You've seen them?
We waved in passing, answered Pitt, without going into detail.
A great disappointment not to catch Doc's killer, Rogers said sadly. I also had high hopes of being the first to photograph the treasures and Waskar's golden chain.
A washout, murmured Gunn. A damned washout.
Shannon nodded at Rogers. We'd better make arrangements to return to Peru.
Lauren sank next to Gunn.
A shame after everyone worked so hard.
Pitt suddenly returned to life, shrugging off the exhaustion and becoming his old, cheerful self again.
I can't speak for the rest of you pitiful purveyors of doom, but I'm going to take a bath, mix myself a tequila on the rocks with lime, grill a steak, get a good night's sleep, and go out in the morning and find that ugly critter guarding the treasure.
They all stared at him as if he had suffered a mental breakdown. All, that is, except Giordino. He didn't need a third eye to know Pitt was scenting a trail.
You have the look of a born-again Christian. Why the about-face?
Do you remember when a Numa search team found that 150-year-old steamship that belonged to the Republic of Texas Navy?
Back in 1987, wasn't it?
The ship was the Zavala.
The same.
And do you recall where it was found?
Under a parking lot in Galveston.
Get the picture?
I certainly don't, snapped Shannon. What are you driving at?
Whose turn is it to cook dinner? Pitt inquired, ignoring her.
Gunn raised a hand.
My night in the galley. Why ask?
Because after we've all enjoyed a good meal and a cocktail or two, I'll lay out Dirk's master plan.
Which island have you selected? Shannon asked cynically. Ballyhigh or Atlantis?
"There is no island," Pitt answered mysteriously. "No island at all. The treasure that never was, but is, sits on dry land." An hour and a half later, with Giordino standing at the helm, the old ferry reversed course as her paddle wheels drove her northward back toward San Felipe. While Gunn, assisted by Rogers, prepared dinner in the ferry's galley, Lauren searched for Pitt and finally found him sitting on a folding chair down in the engine room, chatting with the chief engineer as he soaked up the sounds, smells, and motion of the Alhambra's monstrous engines. He wore the expression of a man in the throes of undisguised euphoria. She carried a small bottle of Blanco tequila and a glass of ice as she crept up behind him. Gordo Padilla smoked the stub of a cigar while wiping a clean cloth over a pair of brass steam gauges. He wore scuffed cowboy boots, a T-shirt covered with bright illustrations of tropical birds, and a pair of pants cut off at the knees. His sleek, well-oiled hair was as thick as marsh grass, and the brown eyes in his round face wandered over the engines with the same ardor they would display if beholding the full-figured body of a model in a bikini. His sleek, well-oiled hair was as thick as marsh grass, and the brown eyes in his round face wandered over the engines with the same ardor they would display if beholding the full-figured body of a model in a bikini. Most ships' engineers are thought to be big, ebullient men with hairy chests and thick forearms illustrated with colorful tattoos. Padilla was devoid of body hair and tattoos. He looked like an ant crawling on his great walking beam engines. Diminutive, his height and weight would have easily qualified him to ride a racehorse. "Rosa, my wife," he said between swallows of Tecate beer. "She thinks I love these engines more than her. I tell her they better than a mistress, much cheaper, and I never have to sneak around alleys to see them." "Women have never understood the affection a man can have for a machine," Pitt agreed. "Women can't feel passionate about greasy gears and pistons," said Lauren, slipping a hand down the front of Pitt's Aloha shirt. "Because they don't love back." "Ah, but, pretty lady," said Padilla, "you can't imagine the satisfaction we feel after seducing an engine into running smoothly." Lauren laughed. "No, and I don't want to." She looked up at the huge A-frame that supported the walking beams, and then to the great cylinders, steam condensers, and boilers. "But I must admit it's an impressive apparatus." "Apparatus?" Pitt squeezed her around the waist. "In light of modern diesel turbines, walking beam engines seem antiquated. But when you look back on the engineering and manufacturing techniques that were state-of-the-art during their era, they are monuments to the genius of our forefathers." She passed him the little bottle of tequila and the glass of ice. "Enough of this masculine crap about smelly old engines. Swill this down. Dinner will be ready in 10 minutes. "You have no respect for the finer things in life," said Pitt, nuzzling her hand. "Make your choice. The engines or me?" He looked up at the piston rod as it pumped the walking beam up and down. Beam up and down. "I can't deny having an obsession with the stroke of an engine." He smiled slyly. "But I freely confess there's a lot to be said for stroking something that's soft and cuddly." "Now there's a comforting thought for all the women of the world." Jesus dropped down the ladder from the car deck and said something in Spanish to Padilla. He listened, nodded, and looked at Pitt. "Jesus says the lights of a plane have been circling the ferry for the past half hour." Pitt stared for a moment at the giant crank that turned the paddle wheels. Then he gave Lauren a squeeze and said briefly, "A good sign." "A sign of what?" she asked curiously. "The guy's on the other side," he said in a cheery voice. "They've failed, and now they hope to follow us to the mother lode. That gives an advantage to our team." After a hearty dinner on one of the 30 tables in the yawning, unobstructed passenger section of the ferry, the table was cleared and Pitt spread out a nautical chart and two geological land survey maps. Pitt spoke to them distinctly and precisely, laying out his thoughts so clearly they might have been their own. "The landscape is not the same. There have been great changes in the past almost 500 years." He paused and pieced together the three maps, depicting an uninterrupted view of the desert terrain from the upper shore of the Gulf north to the Coachella Valley of California. Thousands of years ago, the Sea of Cortez used to stretch over the present-day Colorado Desert and Imperial Valley above the Salton Sea. Through the centuries, the Colorado River flooded and carried enormous amounts of silt into the sea, eventually forming a delta and diking in the northern area of the sea. This buildup of silt left behind a large body of water that was later known as Lake Cahuilla, named, I believe, after the Indians who lived on its banks. As you travel around the foothills that rim the basin, you can still see the ancient waterline and find seashells scattered throughout the desert. "When did it dry up?" asked Shannon. "Between 1100 and 1200 A.D. "Then where did the Salton Sea come from?" "In an attempt to irrigate the desert, a canal was built to carry water from the Colorado River. In 1905, after unseasonably heavy rains and much silting, the river burst the banks of the canal and water poured into the lowest part of the desert's basin. A desperate dam operation stopped the flow, but not before enough water had flowed through to form the Salton Sea, with a surface 80 meters below sea level. Actually, it's a large lake that will eventually go the way of Lake Cahuilla, despite irrigation drainage that has temporarily stabilized its present size." Gunn produced a bottle of Mexican brandy. "A short intermission for spirits to rejuvenate the bloodstream." Lacking the proper snifter goblets, he poured the brandy into plastic cups. Then he raised his. "A toast to success." "Hear, hear," said Giordino. "Amazing how a good meal and a little brandy changes one's attitude."
"We're all hoping Dirk has discovered a new solution," said Lauren.
"Interesting to see if he makes sense." Shannon made an impatient gesture. "Let's hear where all this is going." Pitt said nothing but leaned over the maps and drew a circular line through the desert with a red felt-tipped pen. "This is approximately where the Gulf extended in the late 1400s, before the river's silt buildup worked south. Less than a kilometer from the present border between the United States and Mexico," observed Rogers. "An area now mostly covered by wetlands and mudflats known as the Laguna Salada." "How does this swamp fit into the picture?" asked Gunn. Pitt's face glowed like a corporate executive officer about to announce a fat dividend to his stockholders. "The island where the Incas and the Chachapoyas buried Huascar's golden chain is no longer an island." Then he sat down and sipped his brandy, allowing the revelation to penetrate and blossom. As if responding to a drill sergeant's command, everyone leaned over the charts and studied the markings Pitt had made indicating the ancient shoreline. Shannon pointed to a small snake Pitt had drawn that coiled around a high rock outcropping halfway between the marsh and the foothills of the Las Tinajas Mountains.
"What does the snake signify?"
"A kind of X marks the spot," answered Pitt. Gunn closely examined the geological survey map. "You've designated a small mountain that, according to the contour elevations, tops out at slightly less than 500 meters."
"Or about 1,600 feet," Giordino tallied.
What is it called? Lauren wondered.
Cerro El Caparote, Pitt answered. Caparote in English means a tall, pointed ceremonial hat, or what we used to call a dunce cap.
So you think this high pinnacle in the middle of nowhere is our treasure site? Rogers asked Pitt.
If you study the maps closely, you'll find several other small mounts with sharp summits rising from the desert floor beside the swamp. Any one of them matches the general description. But I'm laying my money on Cerro El Caparote.
What brings you to such an uncompromising decision? Shannon queried.
I put myself in the Inca's shoes, or sandals, as it were, and selected the best spot to hide what was at the time the world's greatest treasure. If I were General Nimlap, I'd look for the most imposing island at the upper end of a sea, as far away from the hated Spanish conquerors as I could find. Cerro El Caparote was about as far as he could go in the early 1500s, and its height makes it the most imposing. The mood on the passenger deck of the ferry was definitely on the upswing. New hope had been injected into a project that had come within a hair of being written off as a failure. Pitt's unshakable confidence had infected everyone. Even Shannon was belting down the brandy and grinning like a Dodge City saloon hostess. It was as if all doubt had been thrown overboard. Suddenly, they all took finding the demon perched on the peak of Cerro El Caparote for granted. If they had the slightest hint that Pitt had reservations, the party would have died a quick death. He felt secure in his conclusions, but he was too pragmatic not to harbor a few small doubts. And then there was the dark side of the coin. He and Giordino had not mentioned that they had identified Doc Miller's killer as one of the other searchers. They both quietly realized that the Zolars, or the Sope Machaco, whatever devious name they went under in this part of the world, were not aware that the treasure was in Pitt's sights. Pitt began to picture Tupac Amaru in his mind, the cold, lifeless eyes, and he knew the hunt was about to become ugly and downright dirty.